White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Today's date is August 6, 2012, and The Heretics Hour is as hot as the temperatures in August tonight. It was over 100 degrees today where I am, and that is pretty hot. But we have a hot topic, and I have two friends with me tonight to talk about it with me. Although right now I just have one, because the other one is there, but he's having trouble for some reason calling in. We'll hope he gets in. My partner is with me here on the Heretics Hour tonight, Tan Stoffel, who has his own program on Tuesday nights at Age of Treason, called Age of Treason Radio. And I'm really glad that he's here. And David Bailey, who we would like to have a program here, is scheduled to be on with us. And I think he will be on eventually once he gets the right number to call. He says he must be calling the wrong number or something. But David is a politically active, racially aware comrade from Massachusetts who was interviewed on my Saturday afternoon show in June. His website is New England Media Watch. Well, before we start, it's okay because I have some things to say here, so I'll just hold the fort. You know, I'll just hold forth while we're waiting on David. And before I want to mention something that came up last Monday's program with Jet Rucker. I had told Jet that he should talk to Bradley Smith at CODO, Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust, about their mission statement, or about us, the About Us page that they have, in which they use the word crimes when referring to the National Socialist actions toward the Jews. If you listen to that, you might recall that. We were having an agreeable conversation about that. And Jet said that he wouldn't have used that word crimes if it was him. And so I, in the instances that I was bringing up, so I asked him to bring it up with Bradley. And then as it happened, I think Bradley had already removed that word, or if maybe it was more than once it was there from the About Us page, because I went and looked for it, and it was gone. And I don't think it happened that quickly after Jet, but who knows? Next time I talk to him, I'll ask him. But I wrote to Bradley and told him that I noticed that he had made some changes in that About Us page, and I thanked him for it. So that's that. There's a little bit of a noise, background noise. I'm not sure what that is.
That's sort of a scraping sound. Probably me.
Okay. Well, Tan, since you spoke, let's say hello and not make you wait any longer, even though I still got some more things to say. But it's really great to have you again.
Well, I'm glad to be back. I know lots of people enjoy it when we get on together, and so I'm glad to be here and glad to speak with you about what we're going to talk about tonight.
Very good. I am too. You haven't heard from David yet. Is he sending chat messages or anything, or is he just not?
I don't see anything from David, no.
Well, you don't have him as a I don't see. Should I stop here and take a look at my contacts and see if I see him, or shall I just I'm going to get my
I think we should no, just forge ahead
he's,
and
he's on there. He's on Skype, but he hasn't sent me a message. So, okay. Let me get back to my page and we will forge ahead. I wanted to talk about the ADL, and this is how this started, and Tan and David agreed to come and talk with me about it. Yeah, I actually started out because of the recent step up in their campaign to shut down websites they don't like. And my own website, CarolynYeager.com or .net, has gotten caught up in this because the ISP, Internet Service Provider 1&1, was convinced to deny service to Bill Fink's Christogenia website, which takes up several servers. It's huge, and which necessarily includes other sites that he takes care of on these servers, one of which is mine. So this came in the wake of some others that were being shut down, and the ADL was behind it, and that's been talked about in other places. And I wanted to talk about that tonight, but then Bill couldn't come on, So we're kind of taking just a little bit of a detour, but we're still going to Reformation League. And actually, I did mention, just to kind of go over this real quick, that in a recent program I mentioned the letter of July 17th from the ADL to an ISP named Endurance International, and in it they complained of three sites: Ingrid Zundel's Zundel site, Ellie James Anglo-Saxon Israel, which is a Christian identity site also, and Volksfrontmedien.org, which is a German language news site. I'd never seen it before, but I went to look at it. And the ADL told this company that that they had identified the primary 300 websites responsible for promoting hate and intolerance. And when you look at who they target as extremists, you get an idea what some of these websites are. And your site may very well be on their list. They're working on this, and I think they have maybe up their the time that they're spending on it just recently. I can't say for sure because I haven't really been paying attention, but they seem to be going after quite a few people, and they're having some success. So all right, the thing is, you know, when this happens to you, it's very disruptive, and it can take a lot of time to do. It's like if you suddenly were told you had to move from where you live, you know, say you're living in an apartment, you had to move to another one, and you had so many days to do it, five or something, and you had to go and find a new place to live, and you had to move and all. You say, well, you know, nobody killed you, nobody really damaged you, but they just inconvenienced you. Well, these inconveniences can be pretty serious and a big pain in the you know what. So this is one of the purposes, that even if they don't shut you down, they give you a hard time and make you think again, maybe hopefully, about what you're doing. So, and then the other thing is that they decide for everybody. You know, they think they should decide for everybody. This organization of Jews, the ADL, decides for the whole wide world what can be seen. Jews are less than 1% of the world population, but they're going to dictate what is acceptable to be seen by the other 99%. And, you know, and then I just think, I wonder why they're not complaining about pornography websites. Well, because they are not anti-Jewish. In fact, they give Jews employment. So this is all about Jews fighting against anything that would look askance at them, or even come all the way out as some of us do, and just really speak out against them. But you know, they consider that to be intolerable to them, and they're going to put a stop to it. So let me get now back to Tan Stoffel. And I want to just mention here, Tan, to start out, that on your website, your blog today, ageoftreason.blogspot.com, you had some new comments there, and one was from someone anonymous that says this: whites are as intelligent as Jews and way outnumber them. If we would regularly do things like we did for Chick-fil-A Day, applied to societal and political projects, then we could take our country back in a week. So I was going to ask you what you thought of that.
Well, I actually liked the comment that came even more recently, that said, how long is a week on your planet, whatever planet you're from? Because that is my reaction to that comment. I think it severely underestimates the power that Jews have. There is more to it, though. Their power is large, but it's brittle, in that they are outnumbered. So if we use the tactics and the techniques that work for us, which would be force and numbers, then we could prevail. But that's exactly what the ADL and other Jewish organizations seek to prevent, is us using tactics that are effective. They try to prevent us from using tactics that they themselves use, primarily organizing along ethnic, racial, or racial lines. And they try to prevent us from using things that they don't have the ability to use, like numbers. But they do use force too. If the legal route fails them, they'll use force as well. So yeah. I would like to see us unite. I would like to see us advocate for our own interests. But it will be longer than a week. It will take longer than a week, even if we all get on the same page about it.
Yeah, it seems like we can do all these things, but I think if we really all got on the same page, maybe so. But we're getting on the same page and is part of the difficulty in what you might call logistics.
In communication, that part of the reason that they try to disrupt our communication is to keep us from getting on the same page. When they can, they prevent the communication from happening. When they can't prevent the communication from happening, they poison it. They come in and start injecting these sock puppet type arguments and creating divide and conquer type situations where people just fight with each other instead of coming to a clearer understanding of what's going on and the threat we face. We're encouraged to fight amongst ourselves by agents provocateur.
Yes. All right, well, we're gonna discuss that tonight, and we might do that more in the second hour than the first hour, what we can do, how we can go about this. But I'd like to start out by, I came to a couple conclusions. I was really studying the ADL website yesterday and learning about them and looking up some other research about them, and I came to the conclusion about what were their enemy number one and number two that they really care most about. And would you like to hazard a guess what you think their enemy number one is?
White people. I don't know if they stated that explicitly, but that's who it is. Europeans.
Well,
that's the 2,000 years of the Jewish narrative of Jewish history amongst Europeans, is that Europeans are their biggest enemy.
Yes, well, in general, that's true. But specifically, I would say that it's Holocaust deniers. Because just studying what they've said, and even in their early writings, they brought that up. They didn't bring up Holocaust deniers, but they would bring up the Holocaust. So that's what I say is the number one enemy that the ADL sees is Holocaust deniers, because of the importance that sacredness that the Holocaust they want to make it stand for. And that's better understood. When you say, I think that enemy number two is Christian identity, and that's actually what white supremacists, you know, that comes under the heading of white supremacists, which is what they hate. But Christian identity, they really go after. I was surprised at that. They've written a lot about it, and they're obviously it's something they would like to get rid of because it denies the Jewish history. You know, the way that their history is so important to them. So I see these both in the category of Jewish fables by which the Jews fool the world. One is their immense suffering, which is personified best now by the Holocaust. And the other is their divine origin and specialness to God based on their ancient historical account of their, you know, their relationship to God and how they were God's chosen people and that whole biblical thing. All that's very important to them, and these two things, Holocaust denial and Christian identity, give a very different picture of that. And also, they're persuasive, and as they start persuading more people, they get worried, and so they're really targeting them. You notice that they tried to take down, and they did get it taken down. I don't know if it's back up again. It probably will be, if it's not already. Eli James, Anglo-Saxon Israel. Now, why would they care about that? He's kind of a mild fellow. I mean, you know, he's not doing any much damage to anybody, but they closed that site down, and then they went after Bill Fink's Christogeny, and he's been up for years, you know, and never had any trouble, and never had any trouble with his ISP, the same one. And suddenly he's just forced to go and find new homes, you know, and move everything. And it's a huge job. So, you know, I found that really interesting as to how they think. Now, just to go into their history. My mind keeps going to David Bailey. I can't figure out what happened to him. I guess he could call, but I don't know why he's just he's on Skype, but he's not trying to call for some reason. All right, it was founded in October 1913, which I'm sure you're aware of, Tan. And it was it was the reason for it, supposedly, was the hanging of Leo Frank, murder trial in the South, in which Leo Frank, a Jew and the owner of a business, what was that business? A big business in a fairly small town, though, not a big town, in which he was found guilty of the murder, rape and murder of this young girl, Mary Fagan, who was employed at his place. And they tried to blame it on other people, especially this colored man who was who gave testimony, who was around there and saw Mary shortly before she was killed. And I don't have all the details of that, but I know that he was found guilty, and then the governor was persuaded by powerful Jewish interests to what's that called? Got it written here, but I'm not looking at it. To give him a reprieve, to change the verdict of the jury. And then the people came and grabbed him, this Leo Frank, out of jail and hung him themselves. And so this was like,
that's an example, by the way, of using your power in numbers to get what you want politically.
There you go. That's right. And by the, I've got this in two different places here, but where they, where they said that, that this was an example of, all I'm trying to say is that they played up the brutal murder of Leo Frank without ever mentioning when the Jews were writing about it, this brutal murder of Mary Fagan. She was totally forgotten. All they were talking about was how this Leo Frank was unjustly lynched by a mob, even though he was found guilty by the jury. Well, anyway, that was the beginning of the ADL, and it was organized by the Independent Order of B'nai B'rith, which is called a Jewish service organization in the United States, which, as we know, had a lot of powerful people involved in it. And in their original mission statement, it said it was to stop, by appeals to reason and conscience, and if necessary, by appeals to law, the defamation of the Jewish people. So they had been concerned about Jewish defamation of Jews for quite a long time, but this was the thing that got it going. And the person who did this was... supposedly, the person who started it was Aaron. No, that's B'nai B'rith. I think I've got this stuff organized real well, and then I add things, and then pretty soon I can't tell where I'm at. I'll just go in order here. And then they say that the ultimate purpose is to secure justice and fair treatment to all citizens alike, and to put an end forever to unjust and unfair discrimination against and ridicule of any sect or body of citizens. And the ADL has 29 offices in the United States and 3 offices in other countries. Just think. And the headquarters are in New York City. Abraham Foxman has been the national director since 1987. That's a pretty long time. Oh, yeah, here it is. The fellow who started it was named Livingston. He was a lawyer, naturally, a lawyer, New York lawyer. I don't have his first name here at the moment. Somebody Livingston. And it was in direct response to the trial of Leo Frank. He was a Jewish factory manager in Georgia. I think his family owned that factory. He wasn't just a manager. Now, As far as the B'nai B'rith goes, it was founded in October 13th also. Wow, is that a special day? 1843. They're both October. Oh, October 13th. The other one is October 1913. 1843 by 12 German Jewish immigrants led by a fellow named Henry Jones. The idea behind the B'nai B'rith was to organize Jews on the basis of their ethnicity. See? To organize Jews on the basis of their ethnicity, not their religion, and to confront what Isaac Rosenberg, one of the founders, called the deplorable condition of Jews in this, our newly adopted country. So now they come to this country. These are German Jewish immigrants. They say, oh, the Jews are in a deplorable condition. Well, back then, 1843, my goodness, the Jews who came were kind of poor. They didn't have that great of prospects, and they weren't that welcome, probably. So right away, they want to change this, and they go to work. They organize themselves to do so. So,
well, I could inject something here. This is one of the keys to understanding the Jewish character and the Jewish identity, is this idea of themselves as oppressed and in living in deplorable conditions where they're being persecuted and prosecuted constantly. And if not actively at the time, then it could happen any moment. And they have all sorts of little sayings about that. And this shapes their identity. This is what informs them about how they should behave, and it motivates them to organize on their own behalf as a group.
As soon as things are not going well for them, they organize. I guess we haven't had things not going well for us enough, for long enough for us to understand how to organize.
It's a combination of factors, but that's a big one, yeah.
Okay, what are some of the others?
Well, the other big one is being told that that's the most horrible thing that we could possibly do, is organize in our own defense as white people. That's horrible, racist, KKK, Nazi, hate, you know, stupid, crazy, evil. It's we're told 24/7 by the media propaganda coming from these Jewish-owned media organizations that have the bullhorn that would be a bad thing for us to do. And lots of white people have internalized that message. And so they don't want to organize because they think it would be a bad idea.
I think we should, I think one way to go about this would be to disseminate the information somehow about how the ADL thinks and why they did what they did and what they have to say. Like here in their, on their website, They're giving the history of the ADL, and in their introduction to this history, they say that many things have changed, mainly for the better, for Jews and other minorities in America since 1913. But, you know, as they get better for minorities, they get worse for the majority.
And that's right.
We need to understand that. I don't think people understand that. When you're helping minorities make things better for them, you are really making things worse for yourself. And, you know, there was a time, and I've said this before, when we were so much the majority that we didn't consider that we could become, it could change so fast that we would not be the majority. But now that is happening, and so that would be something to really point out to people.
Sure.
And then they say discrimination in hiring, schooling, and housing, once so common, is now prohibited by law. See, they're proud of that. Mm. They're proud that we have laws prohibiting us in hiring who we want, in going to the schools we want, and living where we want. So they got rid of freedom of association for everyone except Jews, because you can point out that the Jews have their own schools when they want them. If they want their kids to go to public school, they go to the best ones. And if they want to have their private schools, they have their private religious schools. They don't have any problem with the law. They have their own residential communities that they've built, and they're only for Jews. How do they get away with that? And then in the hiring now, whites are probably last to be hired because of affirmative action.
Well, they get away with it by defining it as hate. It goes to this idea, I guess Alex Linder has been a big proponent of it, I agree, that what they're doing is they're trying to divide speech or any sort of political expression into two parts, the free part that should be protected, and then the hate part, which needs to be controlled and illegalized. And they define what hate is, and they define hate to be anything that's critical of them, anything that goes against their interests. And
yeah,
so,
but what about legally? How do they get away with it legally?
That's how they do it, with an argument like that. It's a disingenuous argument, but if anyone tries to argue with logic against it, well, they just say, well, you're a Jew hater. And they start screaming about the Jew hate. And this creates a scene, and white people just don't, they want to avoid a scene, so they concede. They give in. You know, in part, in the past, I think it was because, as you say, we were so powerful, we were so in control, that we didn't imagine that giving in on these things could ever lead to us losing control. But slowly, over the course of the past century or so, white people have lost control of the United States, and here we are now.
Yeah, here's another thing that they're proud of, that we should not accept, you know, that people just kind of accept in the way that you're talking about. You know, they say, oh, that's right. But here they say, unlike in the past, few Americans feel compelled to conceal their origins. So somehow in the past, when there was all this discrimination, Jews conceal their origins, but now they don't have to. I don't know who else would have concealed their origins, because a lot of these people, you can tell by looking at them.
Yeah, that sounds like that's a Jewish thing too. It's this passing, trying to disguise themselves with plastic surgery and changing names.
Okay, here's David. You want to take his call?
Yeah, let me see if I can.
You see it?
Yeah. David. He shows us on. David, can you hear us? Maybe fix your audio.
Yeah.
We can't hear you. There. We heard a little warble there.
Hey, David, say something.
Hi, how are you, Carolyn?
Yeah, is there something?
You're breaking up a bit.
Is there something different about your mic or anything?
No, I'm talking to you through my laptop like I did last time.
Well, it's not sounding like last time. Last time it was fine.
I'll see what I can do on my end.
Okay, go ahead and do
that. It's a bit garbled, David.
All right, and the I'll just continue while he's working on that.
Right.
Okay. Another is the they say offensive caricatures rarely appear in the mass media, and racial and religious stereotypes, on the whole, no longer dominate American popular culture. See, they have stomped all that out. You can't have caricatures.
Except they haven't. They've stomped out the anti-Jewish ones, the ones that are critical of Jews and their allies. But they Hollywood is full of anti-white caricatures.
Well, but they say offensive caricatures. Those are not offensive.
Yeah,
see? I mean, that's the point, is that it's all for – they want to fix things up for themselves. And as they make it better for themselves, it becomes worse for us. I think this is a good – along with Jews do what's best for Jews and not – this is another good thing to say, that as they make things better for themselves, they become worse for us. And are we supposed to? This is where people blame Christianity. They blame other things. You know, they blame our white natures and so on. That are we supposed to sacrifice what's good for us in order to do what's good for them? You know, there was a time in the 60s and moving along in the 70s and just continuing, where we actually did get that idea. Well, we have been in charge so long. We have it so good. And look at these poor people. These were, the Negroes, not the Jews. The Jews were helping this along. The Negroes and others who, we have to make room for them. We have to let them into our schools. We have to let them, into their restrooms, whatever, We have to let them into all these places. We owe it to them. We need to do this. And we were actually willing at that time, as I think about it, to say, we'll take less in order to give them some of what we have. That was the idea. But it seemed like the only decent thing to do. And now we're stuck with what we have, see. So you have to think very carefully about doing things for people that aren't like you, and what that's going to lead to. Because now they're so happy because there's no caricature as much about Jews. And they don't mean just drawings. They mean, you know, the way people were the way things were written about and so on. They make a point where, oh, at one point, resorts advertised, no Jews, no dogs. Oh, how terrible that was. Makes us laugh. But, you know, that they were being compared to dogs or in the same class as dogs or something. But that's no longer the case. So they say these efforts, these changes are due to the efforts of the League and its allies. But they say one thing has remained the same, the persistence of anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry. Okay, then they want to include blacks, Hispanics, Asian Americans, gay men, and lesbians. But, you know, this anti-Semitism persists. They can't get rid of that because you can't get rid of that by law, can you? You can't make it illegal. You can try, but it's an attitude people have, right?
Yeah, it is unavoidable because it's created by Jews. If there weren't any Jews, there wouldn't be any anti-Semitism. And that's just a simple, plain fact. And, of course, the Jews can't face that fact and want to silence anyone who says anything like it. You speak about laws against it. As I recall, one of the first laws in the Soviet Union was to make anti-Semitism a capital crime, punishable by death. That's what they'll do once they have enough political control in this country. That's what they'll do.
Yes, and now another thing they say that's interesting is that, they go on about the hate mongers, and they may be lacking in numbers and in economic and political power, but they still have the ability to cause emotional pain, physical injury, property destruction. I imagine that means, you know, drawing swastikas on their synagogues or something like that, or, you know, anything they come up with. That doesn't work, David. Something, your voice is all garbled. Not to mention, they add, the incalculable damage they do to the social fabric of America. Now, here's where they decide what is the social fabric of America, and that if we want to be bigoted towards Jews, immigrants, blacks, Hispanics, Asian Americans, gay men, and lesbians, this is damaging the social fabric of America, see? And so, you know, again, it's like they're defining through this whole thing. They're defining what America is and what it should be and what our values are. And of course, they are to include everyone and be tolerant and so on. And some of us bigots don't want to go along with that. And that we're not going away. They're trying to get rid of us altogether. They say the social fabric of America and to this country's cherished ideals of mutual respect and equal treatment for all. Okay, this is America's cherished ideals, mutual respect and equal treatment for all, you see? And, you know, I just say, since when was equal treatment for all this country's cherished ideals? You know, the Jews invent that.
Well, they take little shreds and pieces of our own history, and they weave that into the story. But you're right, it's the reason why the social ideals are what they are today is because they're shaped by Jews, and because it's not white people defining these norms anymore.
Yeah, so now they say the mission of the ADL today, as it has been in the past, is to expose and combat the purveyors of hatred. And so they feel whoever they decide is is a purveyor of hatred, they can go after. And they say, once we protested admissions quotas at leading graduate schools. Oh, they're so proud of that. They got rid of those. They got rid of those so because they limited the number of Jews who could get into these graduate schools. Now, Jews are totally overrepresented in graduate schools. So they didn't help the equal treatment for all at all. And then they say today we expose internet sites devoted to Holocaust denial and white supremacist propaganda. Yep. That's partly where I got that. This is where, you know, they don't want these sites with Holocaust denial and white supremacist is, of course, Christian Identity is white supremacist. If there's anything that's white supremacist, it's Christian Identity. They call a lot of things white supremacist that aren't, but that actually is. But they base it on religion. Just, you know, the Jews have their Jewish supremacy based on their religion, right?
Well, that's Holocaust denial, to me, is a euphemism. It's one of these twisted Orwellian terms that they use. That what its real meaning is, this is a person, when they call you a Holocaust denier, this is a person who won't put Jews on a pedestal. This is a person who won't put the interest of Jews ahead of the interests of their own kind. That's what it means. And that's what they want to prevent. They want everyone to serve their interests, to put their interests ahead of their own group. They want Jewish interests to be first and foremost in everyone's minds. And if you don't do that, if you actively struggle against them, well, you're a horrible Jew hater, an anti-Semite, and they're going to crush you. And they're going to cry out in pain as they crush you. It's bizarre.
Okay.
It's intolerable.
So, you think this is any reason why some people and websites today have moved in the last few years or so, have moved away from Holocaust revisionism and say that, you know, we don't need that. They don't want to be involved in that because the ADL is putting Holocaust denial as number, you know, first on their list of what their internet sites that they want to expose.
Well, sure. Jews are not just the Holocaust, but anything having to do with Jews or criticism of Jews is becoming more and more taboo, and in more and more countries, it's becoming illegal.
Yeah, so it's growing. It's not improving. You know, I mean, they're making progress. The Jews like the ADL are making progress with that, and so instead of standing up to it, what so many of our people who are racially aware and so on and dealing in racial issues are saying, I'm not going to deal in that part. Some of them don't even want to talk about Jews. So that way they can be comfortable. They can continue what they're doing without any fear from the ADL. And this is part of how this works. You know, they do intimidate people away from the things that would be most effective against Jewish power.
Yes, that is part of the purpose, too. The intent, certainly, is to make an example of one or more so that others see the example and are intimidated by it. Yes, of course. But as far as me, what my sense of it is, and maybe it's because I don't associate so much with people who are constantly urging me to do that, I tend to go away from that. I see more people, and the people who comment on my blog and the people certainly that I talk to are on board with the way I see it, and that Jews are involved, and we're not going to solve our problem by trying to avoid talking about it for whatever reason. A lot of people are making up rationalizations, I do see that, not to talk about the Jews, they're too powerful, or you're imagining things, you know, whatever. There's a lot of different conflicting reasons that don't make any sense when you try to put them together. But I don't pay attention to anybody who says that. I don't consider an ally or a potential ally because they're either confused or deliberately trying to go against what makes sense. They're not on our side.
Exactly. Very good. So this leaves, I have to mention some people and give people credit for things. This leaves CODO, which I mentioned earlier, Committee for Debate on the Open Debate on the Holocaust. Well, they have to, because that's what they are. They stick with Holocaust revisionism. And they may be getting a little bit firmer now instead of going the other way. they've had some, you know, some remaking and some people there and so on. And they may start, I don't know, but they're not going to get as strong as I might think they should. But, and maybe that wouldn't be very wise either, you know, because there's only so far you should go when you're a big organization. Bradley Smith is a stalwart in that, and they're standing there. And Willis Cartos, American Free Press and TVR, they talk about Holocaust and Holocaust revisionism a lot. They're publishing all those books in the revisionist series. And then individuals like Germar Rudolph, Robert Faurisson's blog, Vincent Renoir's websites, they're in French, and of course the Zundel site. These are all important revisionist sites that people are not going to back down on, because that's exactly what they are, you know, they are revisionists. So, and then I would say that we here at the White Network stand with them, and so does Christigenia, you know, stands for Holocaust denial and Holocaust revisionism. Some people are just not frightened off. I'm not trying to connect all these together. I'm just saying that they're just examples. But, now, the ADL thing goes on. In the past, here they're bragging. In the past, we challenged the anti-Semitic ranting of demagogues like Father Coughlin. In the present, we are no less vocal in opposition to Louis Farrakhan. Well, they, you see, you know, they hated Father Coughlin. Of course, he was a good Catholic. They say the particulars may change, but the goal remains the same, to stand up for the core values of America. Again, they always bring that in, you know, that they're standing up for America's values. And we, or the people who are racialists, are against those values, because, of course, those values are to welcome everybody and have a multicultural society. So that's, you know, maybe we would need, one of the first things we would need would be to work out an idea of our beliefs. And here's where then we, we work out what America's value should be and put it in a different light than they do, and be able to explain why. And it might make sense to a lot of people, you know, a kind of you know, we'd have to have a kind of treatise like this about what we stand for and why. Do you think?
Well, I hadn't thought too deeply about this, but my first reaction is I think the United States is too far gone. I feel connected to white Americans, and I think that we still have potential to create a nation of our own, but it would have to be something new. It couldn't be a reformation. Or what do they always call it in politics? You know, a simple changing of the drapes, you know, to renew things. It's gonna be deeper than that.
Okay. Well, now going on with your history, 1913 to 1920. These are crucial years from the very beginning of when they started, and they say. They talk about the mob outside the Atlanta courthouse where Leo Frank, a northern Jew, well, see, they hate the South, too. Leo Frank, a northern Jew, stood trial after his arrest in 1913 for a murder he did not commit. You see, well, the jury found him guilty of committing that murder, but that governor transmuted his sentence. That was just, you know, influence at work there. But they still stand and say that he did not commit that murder. It was never proven or something. And the anti-Semitism, was what caused,
Right. That's the true crime in the case. And this reminds me of the Dreyfus case in France that, is what was the, I don't know, the grain of sand that created the whole Zionist movement, Theodore Herzl was reacting to, was the way this fellow Dreyfus, who was an officer in the French military, had been accused of treason and selling secrets to a foreign country. And what he saw wasn't a criminal Jew on trial. he saw a setup by anti-Semites, people who just hated Jews for no reason whatsoever and only wanted to accuse this Jew because he was a Jew. And this pattern repeats over and over again, but that's one of the most important ones in recent history. And then there's this Leo Frank fella too. And the one consistent thing is this mindset of Jews that the Jew couldn't possibly be guilty. It's the people who are putting him on trial. They're the ones who are guilty. They're the ones who are the criminals.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's how this is. Now, the governor, actually, Frank was sentenced to death. Then the governor commuted the death sentence to life imprisonment. And then then they say in August 1915, well, that was like 2 years later, the Yankee Jew was lynched by a mob calling themselves a vigilance committee. So we can't have vigilance committees. We can't have citizens groups or anything like that doing anything. That again is an attack on that. And then they'll say the brutal murder of Leo Frank did not occur in a vacuum. Well, see, again, as I mentioned earlier, there's no mention of the murder of Mary Fagan in all of this. The only thing they talk about is the murder of Leo Frank. And they say, as the 20th century dawned, anti-Semitism was rampant in an American society. An American society. Maybe they're just talking about that town in Georgia, because there was no great amount of anti-Semitism in America at that time. And Henry Ford book talks about that we've been reading. So, but he says if Jews weren't allowed everything, if there was, you know, like this, he brings up this no dogs, no Jews. And he said magazines featured humorous caricatures of Jewish people. Well, probably they were humorous. You know, there was a certain stereotyping. It wasn't meant to be nasty, I guess. But that they don't want that either. That's not okay. So it was in this atmosphere, he says, that the Anti-Defamation League was established by this lawyer, Sigmund Livingston, in 1913. Well, then if the Anti-Defamation League was established in 1913, it was before Leo Frank was hung by the so-called mob, a vigilance committee. It was just at the during the trial and when he was found guilty. And then the governor commuted it to life imprisonment, but that wasn't good enough for these Jews. They wanted the man to be free. They said he was innocent. And so they already started this Anti-Defamation League before that hanging of Frank ever took place.
Yeah. Another example is Pollack, the fellow, the Israeli spy, Jew that's in prison right now, and the constant Jewish efforts to get him exonerated and removed or dismissed from prison.
Well, that's right. It's the same pattern. Always, always, always. Of course, the Jews are never guilty. It's always anti-Semitism that's at fault, just like you said.
It's not just in these individual cases of individual Jews on trial. This is what anti-Semitism is all about. If you look into anti-Semitism, what is anti-Semitism? I know there's Wilhelm Marr, the German fellow who coined the phrase. I know what he intended it to mean, and I know you've embraced that meaning of basically resenting and resisting Jewish rule over you. That I accept as well. But what anti-Semitism means to Jews when they use the term is it's a scapegoat. It's you know, everybody else is the problem. You know, they tell a story, their narrative of their history amongst Europeans is getting kicked out of every European country, sometimes repeatedly over the course of their time in those countries. But when they tell that story, it's from their point of view that this was a bad thing, and all of these people throughout time were the bad guys. They're the villains. The Jews didn't do anything wrong, and it's an absurd story. The point of view is enough. All you have to realize is, hey, I sympathize more with the Europeans, and I think that the story is more likely that they did something that instigated those people to kick them out of their country. They were doing some sort of criminal activity. It wasn't just the people imagined that the Jews had to be kicked out for no reason whatsoever. And so this has become Jewish apologetics. This Jewish intellects have for a long time, certainly since the emancipation of Jews in the early 1800s in Europe, have been telling this same story, that it's all Europeans' fault. Everything that any conflict between Jews and anyone else is always the anyone else's fault. It's never the Jews' fault.
And then they lie. Then they start in with their lying, talking about how they this Sigmund Livingston, he started this with only two desks in his office, in his Chicago office, $200. And the sponsorship of the Independent Order of B'nai B'rith. Well, what does it mean, $200? I believe that is a number they just pulled out of the hat because it sounds pretty good. 100 would not be quite enough, but 200 might be believable. If they've got B'nai B'rith sponsoring them, they've certainly got more resources than $200. They're just, this stuff is so, you know, you have to be so darn cynical. You have to be totally cynical, or you're just going to be pulled into their stuff, you know, their make-believe stories. And I already gave what their mission was. So they took steps to eradicate the negative images of Jews in print and their stereotyping on stage and in the movies. And then right away, in their infancy, Adolf S. Oakes, publisher of the New York Times and an ADL executive committee member, wrote a memo to newspaper editors nationwide, you know, discouraging the use of objectionable and vulgar references to Jews. Well, sure, if you've got somebody like the publisher of the New York Times on your committee, you know, now if we started a committee like this, who would we have? Who could we get that would, you know, would we have somebody like that? Heck no. And then he's writing to all these newspaper editors, and he's telling them what they should do and what they shouldn't do. So this is powerful stuff. So then they report that within two years of the time they began, only 50 cases of such objectionable references to Jews were found in the national press. So, you know, that was a great improvement, I guess. So you see how fast all this worked, how fast they were able to change comments or mentions about Jews. And they say by 1920, the practice had virtually stopped. So they were very, very effective. Then they talk about World War One and, you know, how people were. They go on through this whole history. It's a history of how anti-Semitism has changed. The different ways that Jews are discriminated against, you know, and it brings it up to date. It's always changing. After they get rid of one thing, it moves somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, I would say point out that I think I don't know this for a fact, but I'm sure I would like to look into it. Is the tactics that they used to defend the Jewish people from these horrible statements wasn't to counter the horrible statements with demonstrations that they were wrong or incorrect or whatever. What they did was they probably went about destroying anyone who said such things, boycotting them or getting them fired or, you know, in some other way punishing them to the point where they would not only that one person would be silenced, but then anybody watching, anybody who knew of that person or associated with them would also be motivated to stop doing what they were doing. And that's why we couldn't get anybody to join us. It is mainly because of the threat of punishment. If some big wealthy newspaper publisher were to say, "Hey, I like what the White Network's doing. I'm going to write them a blank check, and I'll fund them." If that became public knowledge, every Jew in the world would descend on that fellow to make sure that he was boycotted right out of business. That's how it works.
Well, that's right, because at that time, Jews, to say that Jews were in a terrible shape, well, that was 1863 or something, but by 1920 they weren't, and they owned an awful lot of businesses, and of course they owned the department stores, and department stores are big newspaper advertisers. What they would have done was this Oakes, and, you know, giving out his letter and so on, but it was a message. They networked with Jews everywhere not to advertise or pull their advertising from newspapers that didn't institute this pro-Jewish agenda and stop any kind of anti-Jewish, not only like cartoons or something, but editorials and articles and so on. So pretty soon everybody fell into line. which is just what we're talking about earlier, how we, with the websites, you know, how we fall into line because we don't want to be punished by Jewish power.
Right. They don't have to get them all. They just have to make an example of a few, and then it has knock-on effects.
Yeah, and then they say that during the World War One and the Russian Revolution, Bolsheviks were being portrayed with a Jewish countenance, and there was all this. He said the United States Army Manual published something for war recruits, and it was talked about the Jew was a malingerer and didn't work hard enough. And the ADL protested this all the way to President Woodrow Wilson. I mean, they go to the top, you know, and they actually talked to Wilson, and Wilson promptly ordered the manual recalled. Well, why? Because, again, politics. He needs their financial contributions and their political support and so on.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is what tight organization and networking can do.
The favorable or disfavorable media coverage, too, is another factor.
That's right. So then it goes on, you know.
Hey, do you see the cues? I didn't hear the cue, but I can see it's we've got 30 seconds or less now.
Yeah, I'm not hearing it either.
Yeah.
I'm not hearing it.
Might have something to do with David dropping off.
Yeah, he did drop off. I wonder during the break if we will – I wonder if I'll hear the music. Because well, we are going to our break, ladies and gentlemen, and we will be back in 5 minutes. And in the meantime, Tan will fix anything that's going wrong. Glad he's here. Are we at the break? Yeah. Do I start?
Yeah, you might as well.
Okay, okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. We haven't been able to hear the intermission music, but we think it's over, so we are back now, and David Bailey might call in. We've communicated with him. I don't know if he's got his business fixed up yet, but this is Carolyn Yeager, and I am here with Tan Stoffel, my partner at the White Network, and we're talking about the Anti-Defamation League, and we're going to get in now into more about an example that has come up in our recent time here with this Wade Page person who has been identified as being the shooter at this Sikh temple, and they're making a big deal out of him being a white supremacist and playing a neo-Nazi, bringing all this stuff in. So, Tan, why don't you start out and tell us about that and introduce us to this?
Well, it's breaking news, and it's hard to say what exactly his motivation is, but as usual with these stories, I'm interested in what the media take on it is. And what I see is it's a wet dream for them come true. You know, they've been fantasizing about having a white supremacist criminal to make an example of for years. It's been 20 years since Timothy McVeigh, and the SPLC has been pushing this narrative that white homegrown terrorists are the number one threat to America. And so they finally got a real live example. You know, after what we went through with George Zimmerman, them portraying him as some sort of racist Nazi KKK character. They finally got somebody who actually is white and seems to have pro-white views. But, you know, I'm going to hesitate, and I don't want to jump to any conclusions, that was what motivated him to do that. It could have been something like something personal, a relationship he had with somebody that went sour or whatever that caused him to snap commit this crime.
Yeah, it's you know, we're going to use this as if we had a defamation, anti-defamation league of our own, how would we use it? Well, how would we what would we do about this man? Would we throw him to the wolves, or would we try to stand up for him? Would we try to help him? Would we try to look?
No, I think the example that the ADL sets with Dreyfus and Leo Frank and Pollard is to stand behind your man and attack the people who are attacking him. You can't defend murder. White people just don't want to do that. And I can imagine that in the coming days there will be many advocates for whites that will try to distance themselves in some way from this guy, claim to have nothing to do with him or whatever. But I think the lesson from the ADL is to go on the attack against the anti-white society that we live in. I think some of these news stories give us the fodder for that. They talk about this guy being frustrated and what his frustrations were. He was frustrated by whites losing control of America. This is and whites being oppressed. You know, if we want to adopt some of the Jewish narrative. We could do that.
You know, David is ringing, and I can't get my right page up to answer him. Can you answer him?
Yes. All right. Hey, David. Can't hear you, David.
Hi, I'm here now.
Oh, good. Hey. That sounds loud and clear.
That sounds good. Okay. Yeah, welcome, David.
Hi, how are you doing?
Well, we're doing fine. David, since you're on now, you know, I gave you a little introduction, but if you want to say anything to kind of introduce yourself, go ahead. Otherwise, we'll just join in. You've been listening, I guess.
I've been trying to listen as best I can, and you guys are doing a great job.
Okay, well, I guess you're aware of this Wade Page fellow. If I got his whole name right, they're calling him Wade Page.
Wade Michael Page is his middle
name. Wade Michael Page, yes.
The fellow that shot up the Sikh temple.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
And we're using him as like, if we had an anti-defamation league for whites, how would we proceed in a case like this when something like this comes up? Because they are definitely defaming him in every way possible before they even know anything about him. And, of course, they're talking to the SPLC. And that's another thing that you kind of wanted to talk about, Tan, because it's not just the ADL, but it's the SPLC, but they're different. I would think, I don't know, would it be better to have an organization modeled after something more like the ADL or modeled after the SPLC? They have all this, legal money. They have all these lawyers and stuff. Where would we get that?
Well, that's the point. They attack from different levels all the time, especially in the media, which they've controlled for a very long time. And I was thinking, beyond this particular case that we can address after, I'd like to address what Severus was saying a couple of weeks ago, but I'll get to that in a second. Is that we've got a big issue here, that we have decades of propaganda against us having been worked out, depending on what the particular era was. You have what we've done to the Germans and to the allowed to happen to the Russians 100 years ago, and then what we actually participated in doing to the Germans almost 100 years ago, and then again 70 years ago. And there's a lot of, when you go back to the issue of the ADL having been started up with the murder of Mary Fagan by Leo Frank, there were also other things in play at the time. It was the whole issue about the Federal Reserve Bank that came up, and then
I was just gonna add that because I didn't get that in. I think yes. It might have more to do with that because as I said, this hanging of Leo Frank didn't take place until 1915, but it was the court case was a great big deal. You know, a lot was made out of it, and that he was a Jew
in Georgia, and then they got a sniff it up in New York, and then they got involved with the case as it was unfolding. They didn't even wait for the verdict before they got on it. And you are correct when you pointed out the fact that that pencil factory was owned by his family. He was not just a manager there. He was actually running a business.
Yeah, he was the son, and he was the heir of the company. Well, the Federal Reserve was discussed and worked on by this fellow named Glass, who must be Jewish. I looked him up. You know, in Wikipedia, he was Senator somebody Glass. He had a regular type first name. And another person named Willis, representatives, not senators. And they were working on this banking bill. And he then later became head of the whole the House Banking Committee. But they did this to give it to President Wilson. And they worked for a year from December 1912 to December 1913. That's what it said. And then in 1913, they presented it to Wilson, you know, right before Christmas when everybody had left. And they pushed it through. The Federal Reserve Act pushed it through the House. So, and we know this was in line with starting the income tax. And I don't really want to get into all that now because it will take up all our time. But,
I don't think that's the most interesting point, though, Carolyn, is that at the same time that they were doing that, they also launched the LCP.
Yeah.
And now if you think back.
They also launched the what?
The NAACP.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Well, what year was that?
I believe that was sometime between 1914 and 1917. I'm not exactly sure of the correct date.
Yeah.
But yeah. it was in the ballpark. And I'd like to also hearken back beyond that. There's a lot of conjecture as to the validity and the authenticity of the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. And the fact of the matter is that if you take into consideration the B'nai B'rith, which was a Masonic order that was very Jew-centric, and their ties to other Masonic orders, ultimately.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, let's just stay with the actual obvious history here, because I don't want to get into all these things. We get into something totally different. But it's true. Let's just say this, that they had reached a point where they says, well, we can really make a move now. And let's get this Anti-Defamation League in place so that it can fight showing us in a bad light as we start making all these moves to take more and more power, huh? How about that?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Yeah, so they were doing now, if you could, without all that conspiracy stuff, if you could, you know, show the American people, or show our people, I don't know what the American people is, show our people how this stuff all came about. We should have a very good track written about this if we had our Anti-Defamation League, showing how they actually did that. Because, you know, the Federal Reserve System is very, very unpopular now. Across the board, pretty much.
Sure.
So that's very vulnerable. And tying all this in together would be a real good point. What, don't you think so, Tan?
Well, I do. I think that the points David's making is this full court press nature that Jews have to waging war is they wage it on every front simultaneously, no holds barred. And if we want to take any lesson at all from the Jews, it ought to be that.
Well, then you have to get really serious, and you have to have really hardworking people, and you have to think all this through. Yeah, it's not just one little demonstration in Washington or something.
Exactly.
You know, it's this big. It's a big serious business, and not enough of us are ready to take on such a huge job. We're all scattered around and so on. I know I would just say for myself, and I'm not the person to do this, but anyway, you know, I've got, my plate is totally full, and I wouldn't, and I'm not, somebody who could, start up anything like this, but, we need people, and they don't have to be, outright white nationalists or anything. They just have to be patriotic white people, of various talents and abilities, or somebody needs to, instigate it.
In order to work for white interests, though, they have to be conscious of those interests. They have to be conscious of themselves as white people in order to be accomplishing anything. They're not going to accomplish what's in the best interests of white people by being conservatives or by being Republicans or being Tea Party members unless they also have that consciousness as a white person.
Well, that's true. So how would even something like this get started to say, not full-fledged, but to say, look, we need to put all this together and make it and show it from our perspective. Because what the ADL, what we see from reading about the ADL on their website is that they present everything from their perspective.
Exactly.
You know, what America should be. Yeah.
If I may interject a second.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're answering your own question, and this is what I alluded to earlier, is that we allow everybody else to have their own agenda and their own platform from which they get to be La Raza, or they get to be the Jewish community, or they get to be whatever they want to be. That's why I brought the NAACP up, because that is part of the protocols process, and that is ultimately what the Jews helped create for the blacks. And they've been attacking us on different levels for a very long time. I mean, if you go back just looking at movies from the war era and even prior, you can see the propaganda agenda being run all the time. I used to be a big movie buff, and I was big on World War II because I told you in the previous show I was involved with, I was very big on – I was a militarist. I still am a kind of a militarist, but nonetheless, I was very fascinated by armor. And if you go back to – say 1940 or thereabouts, there was a Humphrey Bogart movie called Sahara, where they laid out the whole liberal agenda for you in relief to the German, who they made out to be one of these very racist Nazis. So it goes back a very long time. But what we need to do is focus on the fact that we're amorphous right now. We've got people like Greg Johnson and that crowd talking about a new right. We've got white nationalists. We've got people that follow David Duke. We've got people who are Odinists, as Severus discussed with you 2 or 3 weeks ago. He's open to the idea that we can be Christians, we can be Catholics, and we can be Odinists, and we can be Nazis, we can be whatever we want to be. But the fact of the matter is, as long as we stick to this principle that he laid down,
You're breaking up real bad. We can hardly understand you now. But I think we got the gist of it. I don't know. Maybe you were going somewhere that I didn't know where you were going. But we need, like you said, I think you were saying that we've got all these different, we're breaking up into all these different directions, and we need to pull together more. And that's why it's probably easier for the Jews, because they're a smaller number of people. And it can be easier when you're a smaller number of people than when you're a large number of people.
They control the media.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a given there. That's a hard one. But still, the thing is not to be worrying about that in the beginning. It wouldn't it be to get people together who are going to put together these ideas of how to do our own full court press, how to come from all the different places and keep it tied together. And using this Wade Page as an example, the Jews went to work together for Leo Frank. Now, yeah, eventually this vigilante committee strung him up, but they were still, they still had that kind of power at that time. It could never happen now. But they were fighting for him. Just like they fight for that other traitor who Tan mentioned, what would we do in a case like this? How would we defend somebody who is being
I don't think you defend Page. That's not necessary. But white people need to understand that the media is anti-white. That there's not a liberal bias to the media. There's an anti-white bias to the media, and the reason for it, it doesn't just come from nowhere. It comes from the Jewish ownership and the very strong editorial control that Jews have over that media. They get to make sure that there's nothing anti-Jewish that goes out in the mainstream media, and they do put in anti-white things. The same sort of crime, if it had been committed by a Muslim, or if it had been committed by a recent immigrant, or if it had been committed by anybody but a white guy, the media would have done their best to hush up the nature of that criminal, and they would have made it, for instance, not necessarily a national story. They might have broadcast it locally, but kept it out of the national news. And if anybody were to say, hey, wait a minute, there were a bunch of white people killed by this non-white guy, well, then those people are identified as a problem. They're racists because they're concerned about white people. That's the media's influence here. And pointing that out to white people, I think, would help us to unite as white people to defend ourselves as a group rather than running away for the hills separately.
Well, how would we point it out to white people if we need to create our own media?
This is the thing, Carolyn.
A lot of people are saying that, yeah. But sometimes this media we're creating doesn't really get to the heart of the problem.
It does when it's very logically placed. If you think about what happened to Shannon Christian and Mr. Newsom, Alex Linda was very involved with making that a big spectacle, and that's how it got into the national news and got onto Fox. So as long as we're specific about what we're trying to accomplish and we choose our points well and really push on all fronts, that the issue we all face.
Well, then people need to get off their behinds, you know.
Absolutely.
I mean, Alex Linder put a lot of time and preparation into that, and it was over fast, you know. I mean, he tried to make it as much out of it as he could, but there wasn't that much response. All the time they spent telling people, you know, to go to whatever town that was now, in Knoxville. Tennessee or Kentucky, Knoxville. Yeah, Knoxville. You know, and trying to get a big crowd there, it wasn't a big crowd, and it didn't all look all that good either, because of some of the people that were there. So this goes to show, you know, how difficult it is.
It is
and
difficult,
it's time-consuming, and you have to sacrifice.
It is. You are right on the mark. It's time-consuming, and it's a question of the Chinese water torture type mentality. We have to keep dripping this kind of information out to the public every chance we get. And I know it's not the most pleasant thing in the world. We don't want to live it. I don't want to live it. I got on tonight late because I'm running like crazy trying to make a living. That the issue here is that we must attack them every chance we get on every level we can, using every form of media we can. I'm on Facebook every day uploading your shows, uploading Bill Fink's shows, Tan's shows.
Good for you.
Everybody who's relevant, I put it on Facebook. I've got 1,000 friends on Facebook. Some of them are family friends. Some of them are relatives. And they never respond. They try to keep their heads down. And I'll be honest with you, I've had two cousins of mine, a female and a male, marry Jews and get divorced in the meantime. And so if I bring these things up, I sometimes get, well, early on anyhow, I got, you know, don't talk about them because, you know, that so-and-so is married to one. Well, what's more important, what the truth is and what these people are about, or hurting one person's feelings that you're not have no commitment to yourself? I didn't tell my cousins to marry Jews, and I didn't tell them to get divorced with Jews or have children with Jews. All I know is that I come from a certain perspective, as we talked about before. My grandfather was Ukrainian, and he was forced out during the Bolshevik Revolution and all that. I mean, so obviously he did what he had to do for what he thought was the best cause to be involved with. We need to do is we need to consolidate on a particular platform and organization that says this is what we truly are and this is what we truly believe, and we will not stand for any kind of deviation from this platform.
Yeah. Okay, how about playing a little bit dirty? You know, like here in this Examiner article about Wade Michael Page, they bring in and now this is going to be everywhere, the Golden Dawn, because they want to include all this stuff. They hate the Golden Dawn, you know, any success that they've had in Greece. So they brought in the Golden Dawn. They brought in the Hammerskins, a long-time skinhead type organization, which I don't think it's probably all that bad. I don't know what it is, but and then they bring in white supremacists, and let's see, what else do they bring in here? They bring in HFFT.
Yeah, the Hammerskins.
Hammerskin forever, yeah. Forever Hammerskin. Yeah, the Hammerskins.
Right.
What?
They're a pro-white gang. Or organization. They're very much related to the music scene that he was part of.
Yeah, so then they've gone on and on into that music and named that one group that which was called, it had kind of a negative name.
There were two groups, Definite Hate and Against Apathy.
Yeah, his group that he formed was Against
Apathy. No
Apathy, and that's good, you know. There's nothing wrong with that. But they tie it in with something about hate. And so then it sounds like it's similar, you know.
Dirty
stuff. So how would we do things to make them? I think we should play dirty with them.
Carolyn, what do they do? They always obfuscate, and they always bring up issues like this. I don't know. I haven't seen the story about this fella and why he shot up the place. I'm sure Alex Jones.
Well, this is interesting because you know what? He was in the military from 92 to 98, and he learned all this stuff. And while he was in the military, he already had tattoos put on himself, and he was already involved in a lot of things, but that didn't bother them because he was in the PSYOPs part of things. It's
exactly.
Very interesting what they might have done to him. And
he was in Fort Bragg.
Yeah, and he never even went overseas. So it's kind of a weird story, but the military thought he was fine for 6 years.
That they thought that Arab fellow was fine too until he unhauled at Fort Bragg of all places.
Yes, that's a good comparison to draw. I think is that the way the media handled that Abu Nidal Hassan, I think was his name, versus how it's Nidal Malik Hassan, the Fort Hood shooter, and how the media's attitude toward him was, hey, let's not rush to judgment. Let's not jump to any conclusions. They had Barack Obama was out making public statements to that effect. We shouldn't blame all Muslims. We don't know that it had anything to do with Islam. And they're taking the exact opposite tact, of course, in this case. They have no idea whether this guy's racial attitudes and pro-white attitude had anything to do with motivating the crime, but they're jumping to that conclusion immediately.
I heard one of the recent things that somebody came out that he had recently broken up with his girlfriend, or she broke up with him or something. That so often is the reason that sometimes these men go berserk.
That's a prospect, Carolyn. But the reason I brought up what I did is that the ADL in the Southern Poverty Law Center, they focus on crime. I mean, maybe this guy flipped out. And I don't know whether we should own him or disown him at this point, because I don't know that much about it. I just saw it recently when you told me to take a look at it. But what the ADL does and the SPLC does is they go after us. Instead of covering the countless black on white crimes that happen in any given period of time, a week, a month, a year, they'll pick this particular fella out for shooting up a Sikh temple. And sure, can we own him? I think maybe if we had a platform that we said, just like the Irish Republican Army had Sinn Féin, they didn't blink necessarily when the Irish Republican Army did something. Whether you believe they should have done it or not, or they were infiltrated by the British, is another issue altogether. But they did have a political arm that went with their militaristic arm, and they did have people that were willing to put skin in the game and people that were willing to talk a good game. And they worked together hand in hand. What we need to understand is when Severus brought up the 6 points 2 or 3 weeks ago, he was giving us a platform and the Ten Commandments in stone to say, this is what we believe in, and we're going to stick to this, and this actually means something to us, and we will not retreat from these particular points. And if you don't have the backbone to stand up and say, yeah, this is where I draw the line in the sand, then they know that you're bluffing. You know, this is like a card game. They don't back down ever. I mean, this has been brought up time and again, especially by Dr. William Pierce. I listened to some of his things in preparation for tonight. And the fact of the matter is they don't back down ever. And on top of it, they find every which way they can, every different level they can attack us on, they attack us on. They infiltrated.
Well, here's the thing. They always bring in the Southern Poverty Law Center to make comments on these things. It's always the Southern Poverty Law Center. And they keep all these records. And they actually came out and said, this Heidi Bereich person, she said, they looked into their research. They had been keeping records on this guy for a long time, but they hadn't lately. So they pulled out their records that they had, and they made them public to everybody and so on. This is kind of sickening. This is the kind of thing we would probably be attacking or pointing out and exposing how they handle. Well, everybody knows how they handle these things. They make these people guilty, and they in the news articles, they right away say things that aren't confirmed yet and about the person. Just like these early news articles are. And,
sure.
And instead of waiting, you know, to find out what really happened. So it could be totally different than what it is. But they make this big splash. So these are things that people need to be educated on, but how do we do it? Let's get back to the tactic.
We counterattack.
Yeah, but who's we? You know, we're talking about this all. Who's we?
We have to decide who the core of us are. If we want Greg Johnston and David Duke and Ted Pike or whatever to claim that they're the anti-Zionist crowd and they're the ones that are the true right, then we're in trouble. What we need to do is understand where the enemy's weakness is. They go after us on an issue like this, and as Tan said, and Tan, by the way, hello, I'm looking forward to listening to your latest show. Though I think, like everybody else, we wish you would do more. You're a great spokesman. The fact of the matter is that, okay, as I was saying before, I don't know anything about this fella just yet except for what I'm hearing right now. But that's not the point. The point is that you and Tan and myself and Bill Fink and all these other people that filter through us to Facebook and all these other things have a resource to go to that agrees on one thing. And if people want me or somebody to go on Facebook and create, you can create a page to go on Facebook and create a page that says it's time that we hung.
I will never go on Facebook. Don't tell me to go on Facebook.
No, I don't understand. You don't have to. You don't have
going
to.
On Facebook. Although I realize they get all kinds of exposure.
This is the fact.
No, thanks.
It feels.
You're not on Facebook, are you, Tan?
I'm not, no. But hear David out. He's saying that he would put the page up.
I'll do it.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't mind doing it. There are other people. Once it gets from me, it goes through all sorts of other people across the world. So what's the harm? I've put my name out here already. It's too late. And to be honest,
yeah, really have. You put your name, your address. I don't see what difference it makes because people. I won't go into that. Okay. But you don't mind, and you're also very good with media.
Well, I don't know about that. I'm not going to make claims for myself. But the fact of the matter is that if you decide what your recourse is and you pick your target, then you fire at the target, and you do your best to take the target down. In this case, as I was saying, I'm not sure about this particular case that you brought up tonight. But the fact of the matter is, why are we dwelling on this particular case?
Well, we thought it would be a good example to discuss how we would deal with it. But I guess we're really not at a place where
I understand that, and that's why I brought up the ADL and the SPLC because they don't sit around worrying about the latest black on white crime or whatever. What they do is they might register that. And what they do is they look for something they can pick out, some way to attack us instead of dwelling on the other issues, right?
We should be looking for issues about Jews.
Exactly.
And others, but mainly we should be looking for issues about Jews to go after.
In this case, Pollard. Why are we sitting around saying kumbaya when we should get all sorts of tweets out and Facebook pages out on the fact that this guy sold out his own company and he should be held up for treason? All right, we'll give him a fair trial. And if he's held up and found in treason, why can't we hang him?
Well, yeah, because he's a Jew. That's why.
But, this is what we have to challenge them on. Why isn't he getting treated as a treasonous person, as he is?
Pollard has been convicted and he is in jail at the moment. It's that the Jews are constantly, organized Jewry is constantly calling for him to be freed.
Exactly. And that's why we have to attack him.
Well, yeah, okay. That would be a good target. That would be a good thing.
This is what
I would think. If we had an organization like this, it would use the good minds that were engaged in running it, and they would determine some areas that would be good to go into, and then we'd go after that, and the word would go out to all the rest of us, and we would focus on that and go after that, all of us in our own way, and bring that so much to the people's attention that even if it was just our people doing it, it would still come to a lot of people's attention. And then we would just push on that and try to educate people in a deeper way about it so they don't just shrug it off and go on their way.
If I may, Carolyn, yeah. I know, you know, there are certain people in the from this movement that are more popular than others and that are held in higher esteem than others. I recall a very good speech by Norman Lowell at the New Right in London. And the reason I bring this up though is not only is he a charismatic speaker, in my opinion, in my estimation, but he does bring up very excellent points. And the reason I'm talking about the Pollard case right now is that he was talking about a specific issue regarding Kurt Waldheim and how Kurt Waldheim was held under a microscope or a magnifying glass and treated like a bug under a bright laser beam from a magnifying glass, and the fact that we should take the same tactics to heart. And when we have the opportunity to burn one of them, and
well,
this
I
is
can,
what...
Yeah, you're talking about Saul Alinsky's tactics, one of his tactics, which is to isolate a target, focus all the energy on that one target until it's destroyed, and then move on to the next target. And what Saul Alinsky was writing about was really just Jewish tactics secularized. He removed the Jewish from it and wrote about these tactics as if they were tactics for radicals to use in general. But they are successful tactics, whether it's Jews using them or anyone else. In this case, for Wade Michael Page, I think the target is the SPLC. It's the SPLC that is behind every one of these articles. That's who they're quoting when they call this guy a white supremacist. And when they talk about him as if he's some sort of criminal just for having those thoughts, forget it, set aside the fact that he shot people, killed people. He's a criminal simply by calling him a white supremacist. They've already inculcated that idea into everybody's head that white people resenting being displaced and dispossessed of their own country by alien colonization, like these Sikhs are doing in Wisconsin, that it's the white people that are to blame for this. And people like Page or us who think that's wrong, that we should have our own country and we shouldn't be colonized by other people, we shouldn't tolerate it, that we're the criminals. And it's the SPLC that's behind that, and they're the ones that we should focus like a laser beam on exposing to other white people as an anti-white organization. They're not for peace and love and understanding. They're opposed to white people having the rights that they want Jews and everybody else to
have.
Well,
you know, I read in one of these articles about Page that these Sikhs, their belief is to never cut your hair. So these men, I guess it maybe is just for men. Of course, the women, they might not either. But the men never cut their hair or their beards. So they just keep growing, and they wear these turbans. So I guess they wrap all this long hair of theirs inside this turban that they wear. And I thought, you know, why are they coming to the United States of America to do this, you know, to live like they want to live? They don't want to change their ways. Immigrants are supposed to be people who come to a country because they want to become a part of that country. That's the whole idea of immigrants in the past. But now it's just mixing, race mixing and religion mixing and all this mixing people together. So nobody expects them to change. Nobody expects them to become Americans. They're not Americans. What the hell are they doing here when you think about those people? And they say, well, we never hurt anybody. We're so peaceful. Well, maybe so, but why don't you stay home? What do they think they're going to accomplish dressed in turbans and never cutting their hair and stuff like that?
It's this twisted version of freedom.
We don't have to fall for that. I mean, I think we should point things like that out and not be afraid. People say, well, that's not very nice to say. It's, you know, it's not about being nice.
Not on our behalf, but the media has, I mean, I whenever I hear these phrases, I have to think of my own pop culture lifestyle I was a rock musician. I remember Jimi Hendrix saying, wave your freak flag. So We've been inculcated with this kind of mentality for a very long time. But, Tan, I'm not saying we don't attack on other fronts, too. Absolutely. We shouldn't go after Pollard. We should make a big stink about Pollard, especially now, because they are making a point of trying to get him released, maybe by the end of Obama's term, maybe if they get him in again, or they choose to put Mitt in, who knows. They'll get him out one way or another. And obviously, the people that died on the other side of the Iron Curtain, because of him, there's no question the man should be, there's a firing squad, hanging, whatever, is fully justified. But the fact of the matter is that they own the language. They say white supremacist. If I say that I'm for having white people have their own countries, not necessarily the United States. We are already bogged down in almost 50-50 of all sorts of other races. I'm not saying that. The sad thing about it is that we can't protect Europeans or all of Europe from these other races that decide to step on them, whether it's China or with China and Africans or whatever they want to do at this point, because the Jews always let them in. They let the Moors into Spain. They let the Turks into the
Byzantine Empire.
Exactly. They're going to do it one way or another, and I think ultimately we have to make a point of saying that this particular nation here, or country that should become once again a nation, the United States, has to be the standard bearer and has to focus on the fact that we need to lay down the law as to what we are about, period. There's no discussion about it. How we get to it, whether we decide to peaceably separate on this continent itself, or be willing to bite the bullet and send people back to wherever they came from, and even...
Well, we're so far away from that, and we can't even form
anti-defamation
league for white people.
But
that's
Carolyn,
what we should be talking about.
Think about it.
Everybody wants to talk about how we're going to get rid of everything we don't like, and there's no way to do it.
But think about how long ago the protocols of the Elders of Zion were laid out, and how unapproachable that goal.
Oh, well, that's been going on for their program's been going on long before that.
They have a game plan, but it's successful. Why don't we use it? Right?
Go ahead, Dan.
Their tactics are not going to work for us. The main thing that I think Jews used against us was our own universalist tendencies in moralizing, and they got control that way, and we're not going to win power back by trying to do the same thing back to them, because they're wise to it.
They're absolutely
okay.
So
we don't want to moralize. I would agree with that. What we do
this is that it's stealthy. A lot of what they do is in the dark. It's behind closed doors. Hidden, and the meaning of what they're saying is deliberately double meanings. They are using these universalist sounding things, but that's not the intent, and that's not what actually happens. Our strength would be to pull this stuff out into the open, to talk about it openly. They want to keep it silenced. They want to define it as hate and illegalize it. So whatever they want to define as hate and illegalize, that's what we need more of. We need more open and honest talk about this from more people.
Well, where do you think the problem of that is? That sounds great to me. Well, do you see a problem amongst us with this open and honest, and who's it coming from, or why is it there, or is it just that people, we all have different ideas about how to go about things?
Well, this is why I keep saying we need to have a core platform and a core belief, and this is what it is, period. And we have to say that we are the standard bearers of that particular belief system. As Severus was saying 3 weeks ago, he's got the 6 points. Why is that not being etched in stone and becoming
I don't know what the 6 points are of Severus's, but there's the 14 words, David Lane's 14 words.
And that too
holds that up. And in fact, I've seen that mentioned in some of these stories about Wade or Page. that mm-hmm. is he had a tattoo with the number 14 on it, and they're going to try and demonize that. They're going to try
That's
and
right.
make that sound crazy. Well, you know, it's very innocuous. What are the 14 words? You know, we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. Oh my God! You know, that is so hateful.
That should be our preamble.
We should bring respect. Everybody should stand up for that. We should not hide from that and say, oh, and let them turn it into something about hate.
Well, they already have turned it into something about hate, and they're really just dipping into that well. They're going back to the investment that they've made, the millions of dollars they've invested.
Yeah, but how can they justify calling it hate? I mean,
because they define the term.
And people don't know what it means. They just hear a skinhead, hate, white supremacist.
Words, yeah.
They hear all these boogeyman terms.
Yes, they hear supremacist and they think that's what it is. It's about supremacy. It's not about supremacy. Supremacy is about dominating another people. We don't want to dominate other people. We just want our own space. That's not supremacy. That's just separatism. That's all we're asking for
that's going too far to say, well, we're asking for separatism and stuff. I think we're defending ourselves. I think we should portray it as self-defense.
Exactly. And, we want our own nations.
Well, we don't want to be overcome and overwhelmed and ruled by others in our own nation. But, you know, I think we should, like, defend something like the 14 words. We should be explaining all this stuff. This is all a part of education. I mean, how did the ADL went out and they influenced? Well, they were able to get to the influential people, like newspaper editors and stuff.
And they created the language that we
have
to learn by.
Yeah, but how can we go out and reach influential people?
Because we have to define.
Well, I'm asking how. How can we do it, Tan? How can we do it?
Well, I think the Jewish identity preceded the formation of the ADL or any other Jewish organization. So you already had Jews who had a consciousness, their own 14-word program running in their head about doing what's best for Jews. That is an essential element of Jewish identity. And so they create organizations as an offspring of that. For us, the problem is more difficult. We have a problem that most white people won't identify as white. They think that's a bad thing. They don't want to identify as white. And so you can't have people like that create organizations. They're not going to join pro-white organizations. So the first problem we have to address is to say to people, look, you're a white person. You can't escape that. You can't run away from it. You've got a media and a government that is anti-white. They're doing whatever they can as fast as they can to turn your country into a non-white country. They're out to genocide you. You'd better wake up and smell it and do something about it. Organize. And, you know, I can't claim to have any solution to our problems except to say that we've got to organize before we can do anything. We've got to people have to be aware of their interests, be aware of their white identity, and then organize for those interests. And we're going to disagree about it. We're going to have arguments about it. The Jews have lots of arguments about it. Blacks, all these other groups argue about it incessantly. And we will, too.
But you know what the Jews do, what they've always done? They're actually there in a community, and they work in that community. There could be 10 Jewish families, and they will take over school boards. They will take over, you know, the city council and stuff. They will do all that stuff. And so we don't seem to be willing to do that. We're not willing to put ourselves we're not willing to work that hard.
What we're lacking is the principle about what to argue about. What's best for white people? That should be the basis of all of our arguments, not something that's considered radical and hate and bad and negative, which is what it is today. You know, to talk about the radical idea of white people doing what's in the best interests of white people is somebody called it revolutionary when we first started this white network. And it once you make that assumption and you start doing it, it comes like second nature. But you forget very easily that the bulk of white people in this country and elsewhere, or maybe not the bulk, but certainly a lot of people, especially in influential places, have abandoned that. They don't think anything but negative thoughts about organizing as white people or doing what's in the best interests of whites. So Jews will famously argue, but that's what they're arguing about, what's best for the Jews collectively.
Yeah, well, you know, another thing, I think we should use children. You know, we brought up the 14 words. We should look for, if we were working like the ADL does or did, We would be looking for stories about how white children are suffering because of what non-white children are doing to them or whatever. Because children always bring, you know, work on people's heartstrings real fast, you know. And if you're seeing, if you can show children being abused, white children being abused, then that would go a long way. But they're always trying to show non-white children something or other.
That's why we need to use the social media as much as possible. And like I said, I'm willing to put my name out there. I'm not hiding behind any
social media
pseudonym or whatever. Yeah, absolutely. And don't be fooled that there are that many. I believe that there are plenty of people that keep their mouths shut because it's not socially acceptable to say certain things, whether they think them or not.
I would agree with that, David. I think people are silent because they think it's everybody else thinks that it's not right to say these things. But I know when I open my mouth that I get usually support. The majority of people will either nod knowingly or even vocalize some sort of agreement with me.
Absolutely.
So we need to open our mouths more.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's a real important thing. We need to say what we think. Not be afraid to do it and be the first one to say it. Well, this has come up before.
And accept that sometimes it comes out a little harsh and not be so, you know, polite about how it comes out. I'm sure that my best friend would not want to see either of his beautiful blonde daughters end up with a black guy. Whether he's willing to actually say that out loud or not in polite company is another issue.
Isn't that something that you wouldn't be, that you're so frightened or so demoralized that you can't even say something like that, which should be obvious?
Of course. But
people can't even say it about why they move. They talk about moving to a nicer neighborhood with better schools rather than why they really move. And that's not even who your daughter marries. That's just, moving.
Absolutely. And this very same friend took his daughter out of the school she was in because they're allowing blacks to go. It's a Catholic school. They're allowing them to go there from K to 12 for free and subsidize it. Yes, absolutely. And I was in the neighborhood doing some work for a garage right across the street. I saw these people rolling in Mercedes and BMWs. It's not like they needed the freebies.
Well, you know, now here, but this is just one thing here. Well, how do they justify that they want to allow all these blacks? And are these American blacks from several generations, or are these new blacks from Africa that are refugees of some kind? How do they justify letting them, all them, come into the school, Catholic school, without having to pay that tuition?
Well, it's affirmative action. It's 501c3. It's a Catholic school. It's a religious school. They have to subscribe to 501c3. They have to do what the government tells them to do. But the issue here that concerns me particularly as an individual is that there was a black boy there that spit milk in the daughter's face.
Yeah.
And this was a kid that has been troublesome so far. And this is only, we're only talking first grade.
Well, when I was teaching school for 2 years, I went from high school all the way down to grade school trying to get a more peaceful classroom. And there was this one black boy who could disrupt the whole class. He was the only black boy there. He could disrupt everything all the time. And he was adopted by this Christian pastor and his wife. And that's where he lived. And you know, everybody made kind of special concessions for him because he had troubles. Well, he was troubled, all right. You know, and this is just, nobody should think they have to go along with this or speak nicely about these people. They should say what they really think. Of course, as a teacher, I couldn't, but.
Well, and this is what it comes back to, is the whole notion of freedom of speech. And we don't have freedom of speech, number one, because the media is owned as businesses and you can't just post any comment you want. But even beyond that and the societal level, we deal with people that embrace the notion that it's not polite to talk about religion or politics ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, online race.
And what are the most important issues that we ever have to deal with? If we're not allowed to talk to them, or people feel uncomfortable talking about them anytime, whether it's at a party or whether you're sitting in somebody's living room having a whatever, a drink of, you know, club soda in the afternoon, or at a dinner party, they're not allowed to talk about these things. When do they ever come up?
Okay, well, we've got 60 seconds and actually less than that now. So you want to sum up what we've discovered here tonight? Anybody?
Well, I'd like to say just get in one last thing, which is this is an inevitable consequence of diversity and the push for diversity. Diversity is divisive. It's not our greatest strength. It inevitably creates resentment on both sides, on all sides. And murders like this are going to be a consequence of that. They want to paint it as all white people's fault. That's what they're trying to do in the media right now.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the cause of this is diversity, and that's another point that should be made.
And their constant push for it. Yeah. Open borders and forced integration.
Well, I hope that one of these days we can have an anti-defamation league for white people. I would love to see it, and I would love for us to get started in some way on it right now, even if it's just thinking about it. So thank you, Tan Stoffel, and thank you, David Bailey, for coming on the program tonight. And ladies and gentlemen, this has been another Heretics Hour. Come back again next week.
God bless.
Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.